This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So I just want to thank, as always, the Pardes Institute, that's pardes.org.il, for helping to make this class happen. Okay, good morning. So the place that we've reached our discussion is Spain, and there's a bit of a cultural bridge, as we've said a couple of times, right? And I actually tried to put up some numbers on the board here just to help people hold the picture. We had this flow from classic Ashkenaz, which is still the Rhineland, the border area of Germany and France, in two directions, right? This was this like year we talked about the rupture and reconstruction last week, this like 100 years of really devastating blows, and despite my dislike of the lachrymose view of Jewish history, if you're going to pick any century, except for perhaps the first half of the 20th, this is it. This is it, where it's just, you know, between the Black Plague, the Hussite Wars, you know, the expulsions from France, that Ashkenaz takes shattering blows. And the majority of Ashkenaz, population-wise and even culture-wise, will flow over into Poland. That will be our discussion next week. But the crown jewel of the Torah of Ashkenaz, Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, actually heads to Spain. And because of that, we have a unique opportunity to get an understanding of what happens to the Torah. I had this discussion last night with a few people about what is consciousness. Right? And the tagline of this class is Jewish consciousness in its historical context. So without going too far into it, although we're going to need to get there more when we speak about converso consciousness, which is really the goal for today, to understand who were the conversos, and what do they actually add to our story aside from just being another period in Jewish history? Because my contention is they actually add a fundamentally new layer of consciousness. Need a pen? Yeah. Here, you can pass that back. Just please give it back to me. So on one level for the Jews, that's okay. Well, on one level, anybody who wants to take notes deserves attention. On one level for the Jews, consciousness will always be crystallized in Torah. Right, meaning, consciousness is a what to me is an emergent phenomenon in one's life. Just think about it as a baby. You know, you picture a baby Einstein. You know, all those baby Einstein, like the music and the books and like, but real baby Einstein, like a little Albert with two little tufts of hair and the whole thing. Right? Is he all in there? Is the theory of relativity just imminent in this little infant? Like, we could have all kinds of debates about that, but. In reality, the answer is yes, and there's something in life which both adds and develops, and et cetera. And lo and behold, you see the arc. We can do a time-lapse film of baby Einstein to the moment when he receives the Nobel Prize, right? And there he is. It's just that. And there's something which emerges out of this child's life experience, mind, environment, that they're able to give voice to. Now, I'm being very specific in that terms because it's easy to locate the theory of relativity. I wouldn't have come up with that on my own, right? But now we all know that that matter and energy are actually the same thing, and that completely shifts the way we know the world. Remember, consciousness is a knowing of the world. It's the way in which we know the world, and most particularly, it's the way in which we know ourselves within the world. Right? It's not just cognition, which is primarily outwardly focused. It's also the inner I. And so when we speak about consciousness in the Jewish experience, one element of that will always be just the lived experience of the Jews, wherever they are and whomever they are, which is why it's very diverse, because the Jews in Spain aren't really living in the same world as the Jews who are traveling eastward to Poland, to the remnants of the communities in Babel, meaning they don't speak the same language, they don't eat the same foods, they don't have the same sort of historical arc of development and cultural context. Nevertheless, what does unite them? They all believe they're part of the same story, which is a very powerful tool. Remember, a story is that frame which allows you to stitch together all the experiences of your life and your knowledge into a coherent whole. And so therefore, the fact that those diverse groups of Jews in their lived experience are living a very different experience, nevertheless, they're all trying to tie those experiences to the same story is a very powerful sort of shared consciousness. So that's one, let's call it the sort of mass consciousness, but then there's always that product of the intellectual elite, Torah, right? And you can see how that becomes a certain iterative process, because Torah crystallizes without, we'll just call Moshe the first one who does that, without getting into the whole revelation question, right? So Moshe stands at the pinnacle of some group of people, pun intended pinnacle, right? He crystallizes some divine consciousness into this thing we call the Torah. And then what does he do with it? He teaches the people. He doesn't just pass down the keys. He teaches the people, and they experience the world differently now. Through the commandments, through the narrative, they themselves continue to travel through time. And through those commandments and that narrative, you know, you cough up Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who crystallizes it into the Mishnah, right? Who then does what? He turns around and teaches it to the people. And they begin, through their behavior, to change their lifestyles, their experiences, and the narrative which construction. Keep going, you get to Rav Ashi and Ravina, who crystallize it into the Gemara. You understand this process, how Torah, on one hand, is an elite project of consciousness, because not all of us are Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, or Einstein for that matter. But on the other hand, because it's a lived tradition, it's a behavioral system which embodies values and narratives, it becomes mass consciousness. Right? And we've spoken about the rabbinic project of constructing identity with a one-to-one relationship between identity and law. And that's one of the ways in which it's so effective that you can create a group of people who may not know the stories, but they have the practices. Like, I don't really, philosophically, I don't understand what it is to be a Jew, but I see that guy wearing tefillin, and I'm like, ah, we're on the same team. We may have nothing else in common, but we're on the same team. We're telling the same story. We keep the same rules. Right? And so that's a very powerful process, which is going to reach a very important point at this point in our story. Right? Interestingly enough, just as the story, that sense that we're all telling the same story, starts to fragment. Because this is one of the encounters with modernity happens at the end of the story of Spain. Because there's no one encounter with modernity, right? Modernity will strike Spain different than it strikes Italy, different than it strikes Germany, different than it strikes, you know, Babel. It just doesn't work that way, right? We've spoken about the problems of periodization, that it's breaking history into neat chunks. Nevertheless, this crown jewel of Torah, of the Tosafists that we've spoken about so much, in the person of Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, goes to Spain. And then we spoke about the fact that the Rosh meets the Rashba, Shlomo Ibn Aderet, gets a good job as the rabbi of Toledo, right? Not Toledo, Toledo, right? And so there is this process of the melding of these two forms of Torah with some challenges. And right now what I want to speak about is actually not the Rosh, but the Rosh's son, who I think we actually mentioned last week, I can't really remember, Rav Yaakov ben Asher. Rav Yaakov ben Asher, better known as the Tur. Right? Why is he known as the Tur? Because the Rosh's son, the Rosh's eldest son, follows in his footsteps as rabbi of Toledo, right? And his third youngest, or third eldest, depending on how you look at it, son follows in his footsteps as a giant in Torah, right? So the Tur is called the Tur because his great halachic work is known as the Arba Turim. And what I want to do right now is just speak a little bit about what is the Arba Turim and why does it matter?
You're our tour guide.
Well, I will be your tour guide. Yes, thank you very much for that. Absolutely. I'm going to give you some details. In fact, in many ways, it's a response to the Mishnah Torah and the experience that the Mishnah Torah was just too much. But we'll get to that in a second. So first of all, why call it the Arba Turim? Right? The Arba Turim, of course, is referring to the four rows of precious stones on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, of the high priest, right? Which is known as the Choshen HaMishpat. Right, the breastplate of judgment. Right, Mishpat's an interesting word that actually I'm not going to drift into. It's just called Choshen HaMishpat. So those four rows end up being four sections. Right, a tour is a row, and that's why it's called the tour. Right, even though there are four, you couldn't call them the Turim. It just sounds weird. It's plural. Right, but the four sections are Orach Chaim, which is the way of life. Orach Chaim literally means like the path of life. This deals with daily ritual life. I hate that word ritual, but it is effective in that sense. Meaning, it's primarily prayer, although not entirely so. And the idea is it begins when you wake up and cycles through your whole day in prayer and religious obligation, all the way through to when you go to sleep, and then it repeats that on Shabbat, and then it repeats the same thing on all of the Yomim Tovim. And the idea is, here, you want to, like, do Jewish? You do Jewish this way. It's Or Chaim, right? Path of life. Keep on going, depends on how you do it. The next one would probably be called Yoredeya. You know, sort of an instruction of how, Deya is a funny word. Instruction of knowledge, but, you know, Deya also, certainly in the way the Rambam uses it, has implications of character traits and consciousness. It was a funny thing. In the Rambam, in Hilchot Deyot, in the Rambam, you'll find everything from sort of how you should eat to sort of character development, you know, et cetera. Why? Because the Rambam was a holistic doctor. He believed that what you ate actually affected how you knew the world, which, of course, we all know that that's true, be it on a scientific or an experiential sense. So your idea is like a direction in how to know the world. It's largely permitted and forbidden. It includes the laws of kashrut and the laws of family purity and a bunch of other things. But I thought I was going to sort of give it a general sort of like a principle. It's the permitted and forbidden. The next one we'll say is Evan Ezer, which is a biblical reference. These are all biblical references. They're all from Psukim, from verses. Evan Ezer literally means the stone of my help. There's a story of Prophet Shmuel when the battle against the Philistines. But it's not so critical for us. You could really go very deep into this, but it's not our goal today. Evan Ezer, we're just going to say family law. I mean, there's more in there than that. But this is family law, marriage, divorce, certain aspects of property that relate to family law, certain aspects of family purity that relate to family law, but just ofen klali. Last but certainly not least is Choshen HaMishpat. Choshen HaMishpat, yeah. Choshen. What?
Judicial.
Yeah. Well, judicial, I mean, tort and civic law. Right? Damages, courts, right? General, what most people think of when they think of law. Right? So first of all, this four-part structure was so profoundly effective that until this very day, it is the structure on which halachic discourse takes place. This is a major turning point in the structure of halachic development, and in that sense, it's probably worth it just to chart out sort of like really briefly. Right, we'll start with Torah, right? We're going to put what we call the traditions of the fathers, which we've spoken about, like this sort of amorphous origins of the oral law. Right, next big move in structure is what? The Mishnah, right? Then, right, the Gemara. Then, that's the only one, whatever, it's transliteration. Any votes here? So the Gaon, yeah, we'll say responsa. Now, structurally, what's the next big move? This is a hard question, actually. What? One step before the Rambam. The Rif. Right? Rav Alfasi. And now, why do I say that? Because Rav Alfasi is the first person to say these structures are too much. If you've read the Rif looks just like the Gemara. And the Rif does not touch the structure of the Gemara, but what the Rif does is boil down the Gemara to its halachic content, to its legal content. It's a pragmatic approach to the Gemara. Right? So that's why it's annoying, because the pages of the Rif look just like the Gemara, and sometimes if you're not paying attention, you open up to the wrong part because they're printed together today. But the key is the Rif is after a practical solution, you know, the recognition that the Gemara is about what you do. And in order to do that, he's got to take out what he deems to be extraneous material, not just the Agadita, the narrative portions, but also a lot of the Shakavataria, the back and forth discourse of the Gemara, which is inconclusive. Right? But he maintains the structure of the Gemara. Right? The next one you guys said was whom? The Rambam. The Rambam is the first one to break the structure of the Gemara. Now remember, there's many people also in here. What I'm speaking about is structure. right? And as you said, like everybody, and the hallmark of structure is that everybody responds to what you've done, right? If not building their whole construct upon it. And so the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah actually completely uproots the structure of the Gemara and breaks, you know, the other name of the Mishneh Torah is the Yad Chazakah, right? The mighty hand, and it's called that because the Yud Dalid means is the number 14 in Hebrew, and he breaks it into 14 sections. The Rambam takes the Greek model of conceptual structures that move from the abstract concept to the specific case. That's how we all learned, right? And he applies it to the structure of the Gemara. The Gemara is not structured that way. The Gemara is structured experientially. The Gemara and the Mishnah are experiential. I'll give you an example. When I used to teach in the rabbinic, the smicha program that I worked in, the laws of kashrut, the classic way, I don't know if anybody here learned for smicha, the classic way of learning the laws of kashrut is to go from melicha to basar v'chalav to tarovot. You go from the laws of salting to the laws of the mixtures of meat and milk to the general laws of mixture and law. Well, I'm telling you, it is mind-boggling for the average Westerner why you would do that. Because I drop you into this highly specific case of melicha, of salting, with all of these general concepts that, of course, the text assumes you know. And many of them don't receive a general treatment until you get to the third section, because you're going from the specific to the general, rather than from the general to the specific. Now, why would you do it that way? The answer actually is quite apparent when I tell you what comes before the laws of melicha. Anybody know what comes before the laws of salting in the Shulchan Aruch? The laws of slaughter. Well, actually, the laws of blood, and the shechita comes, it's shechita, blood. Meaning, what are we dealing with? Reality. First you kill the thing, then you gotta get the blood out, and then you have a question of how you can eat the meat, can it be mixed? And then that itself emerges, oh, since we have milk and meat mixture problems, are there other kinds of mixture problems, right? The classic rabbinic, and even in Torah mind, is what's called casuistic, right? It's case-based, not concept-based, right? So the Rambam was annoyed by that in the sort of Greek philosopher side of his mind and broke the structure of the Gemara up into these conceptual categories. Is anybody else getting really warm in here? Are we okay? It's very warm. Maybe just turn it off for a moment.
It was warmer before.
Well, it was warm before and has been turned off. Joanne, will you do me a favor? Will you just turn off the heat in here when you're walking out? Thanks. Okay. If it gets cold, we can always turn it back on, but I'm going to fall asleep, and that's a bad sign. The Rambam, as we've spoken about in the introduction to the Mishneh Torah, says, all you need is my book and the Tanakh, and you can live as a Jew. Right? Aside from the fact that the Rambam believed that he had finished the project, he came from that Gaonic, Sephardic worldview that the Gemara and the Halachic project was a bounded project. Right, he also believed that he had finished it. Right, so the Tosfos and the Ashkenazi worldview, we said, reintroduced the dialectic into this development, and the Gemara became an ever-expanding universe. Right, so therefore that project is never done. Right, nor can anyone ever get a clear line on anything. Right, this is the somewhat convoluted nature of Ashkenazi thought. Right? So after the Rambam, in the development of Halacha, there are many people in here. The Rosh is not the least amongst them. Many people after the Rambam went back to writing commentaries on the structure of the Gemara. Many of them. That's a hallmark of the Rishonim. And as well, you know, these structures don't go away. Of course, they were all writing responsa as well. Right? But the next big structural shift is the Tur. So we're going to put the Tur right in there. Now you can understand, and it's not just because of these four, you know, this, if you open up the Shulchan Aruch, which I hope people are familiar with, right, the classic code of Jewish law from the 16th century, the Shulchan Aruch is written upon these four structures. And to this day, if you have someone who's going to write halachic works, they're going to fit into one of these areas. Now, let's talk about why the Torah matters. So first of all, the Torah looked at the Rambam, and he said, too much. It's too bulky. It's 14 sections. People don't know what to do. So what's the number one thing? What's the big revolution of what the Tur did here? What's missing?
We dropped all that stuff about messianic ages and things like that, which are not relevant.
There's nothing about the messianic age. There's nothing about the sacrifices. There's nothing about the laws of purity and impurity in terms of outside of family law. There's nothing about the laws of the tithes in the land of Eretz Israel, meaning only that which can be fulfilled in exile is treated by the Torah. He took an axe to the wholeness of the Torah. If the Rambam, the Rif, said, oh gosh, I don't really want to mess with the structure of the Gemara. It's so important. The structure is so important because it's a way of rabbinic thinking, but I want to help people out, so I'll just give you the bottom line within the structure. The Rambam said, feh, to your rabbinic mind. I've mastered the rabbinic mind. I've mastered the Greek mind. Let me tell you, it's easier to learn the Greek method. So I'll just give it to you in a categorical fashion. And trust me, it's a lot easier to look up the book Brachot and know that you get everything you need to know about Brachot than looking up in Masechet Brachot in the tractate and knowing you're getting most of what you need to know. But you should know that over here and there are the other things you might want to know, right? So, but he didn't get rid of the wholeness of Torah. The Tur took an axe to the wholeness of Torah. And this is an act of significance which I honestly don't think gets contemplated enough in our day. So that's an interesting question. We don't have, like, you know, there's certain classic polemics around the Shulchan Aruch that are very familiar that we'll speak about when we get to them. I'm not aware of a classic polemic against the Torah, perhaps because in his day, what he was trying to do was give a wholeness to the Torah. And that's what's deceptive about it, is that on one hand, he lopped off everything, I'll say it again, everything which, he only included that which could be fulfilled in exile. Right, which is very practical. Right, but so you lose a lot of stuff. But on the other hand, what he did was he combined the views of the Sephardic sages and the Ashkenazic. Right? Meaning, it's a response. He starts with the Rif as the foundation, and the Rambam, who most often follows in the footsteps of the Rif, although not always, and then he begins to compare it with the Tosafists. That's the general pattern. I mean, he also brings in everybody else. It's an astounding work, by the way, which I highly encourage you to read. Yep.
So how do you deal with the Tefillah?
Oh, hold. That's a very good question, but I'm going to get to. Because it's hard to reconcile those two. You can't just go 2 out of 3 on, you know, civil law. Right? Excellent question, Mark. Excellent question. But we'll get to that. So on one hand, there is a breaking off of huge parts of the Torah, and I just want you to appreciate the challenge. When I first started to become religious, and I wanted to know, not only to begin learning, like as an independent skill, but also to know about Torah, the advice I got was the best thing you can do is learn the entire Rambam. Because not only will he teach you Hebrew, because the Rambam's Hebrew is an interesting sort of midpoint between rabbinic and modern Hebrew, right? And it's clear, and by the way, I cannot advocate enough, if you're into daily learning, the Rambam Yomi, the Rambam, like, you learn one parak of Rambam a day, it takes you about 3 years to finish the whole Rambam, is an incredible effort. And for many people for whom the Gemara is a big ask, there are at this point all kinds of, you can get little booklets, you can join groups. It's become similar to the Daf Yomi. But even if you don't do that, there are many editions of the Rambam out there. They're very accessible, and it's much easier to learn the Gemara. So on one hand, you get the language. On the other hand, I saw the whole Torah. I'm like, oh, like, well, I grew up in a conservative, you know, public school education, big C conservative, right? I didn't know, like, all the laws of tithing. I didn't know anything about the priestly service. Now, you might be thinking, like, why do you need to know about the priestly service, Mike? Well, it could be the messianic aspiration. Like, I actually believe the Rambam's messianic vision is a restorationist one, right, that indeed we will one day have a temple again. But there's also an assumption in Torah that the Torah is not a Greek document. I want to explain to you guys what I mean. I've said this to you before, that think back to your 7th grade earth science textbook. I'm sorry. I saw the little... there's always someone in the room who's like, oh, no, can we choose a different subject? You know? No, but that textbook assumed you knew nothing when you got it. Page 1 taught you everything you needed to know to turn to page 2. Right, page 2, page 3, etc. Get to the end of the book, and then you can forget everything. You're fine. No, but you understand that this is called linear learning. It's a very powerful method. It was really pioneered by the Greeks, although, you know, they're not unique in that. But nevertheless, it's an assumption that there's a linear structure to learning, and that what learning means is for me to give you the building blocks to move forward. Right? The Gemara, when you open up to the first page of Brachot, and it says, what's the first, not the mission, the mission is Meimatai, right? But what's the first question? Anybody know the first question on the first page of Gemara? Well, and what's the question on the page? Tana, right, Tana, Hechakai. Where's the Tana standing, so to speak, that he's asking you when you should read the Kriyat Shema? He's not proving to me that I have to read the Kriyat Shema, meaning you jump into the middle of a conversation. It's like, well, how does he know? Whoa. Because the Gemara, when you reach the first page, assumes that you know everything. It's a holistic document. Right? Because the assumption is that you know everything because each piece connects independently to the other pieces. It's true, there is a linear frame there. You can read the Gemara, but not like a newspaper or a textbook. Right? Because it's the Gemara's assumptions of knowledge, its own sort of what's the integration of classic analytical logic and the particularly Jewish textual logic, right? And then just the rabbinic mind and the way it sort of like is the dialectic and the constant questioning and these sort of weird angle views. And they're not tangents. Oy vey. No, anyway. Your rabbi is spinning in his grave, right? Anyway, but you get my point. This is a completely different way of, but it assumes that you have the whole document. So what happens to the Torah when you lop off everything which is not practical? On one hand, it becomes much more livable. Remember what I said is that there's this consciousness which is about the crystallization of this elite thought. Right? The Torah, his father is the Rosh. He's got the whole Torah of Ashkenaz in one pocket. And he's grown up, not quite grown up because he was not young. He was in his 20s when they came to Spain. But he's grown into manhood under the tutelage of the great minds of Spain. And so therefore he's learned all the Torah of Sfarad in his left pocket. He's perhaps the first person in Jewish history to actually receive both at the same time, and he's able to integrate them. We'll speak about Mark's question in a moment because it's an important point you raised there. And so it's a tremendous crystallization which he's able then to give, which maintains a wholeness of legal discourse for all of Am Yisrael, instead of the Sephardic world and the Ashkenazic world being really never the two shall meet. But he also gives back to the Jews, who will now absorb his code and make it a legal code, a Torah which is missing quite a bit. And so therefore exile becomes institutionalized within the halachic system. Now you could say it was always so, and I would agree with you, but this is a big move. It's a big, big move. So the other pieces here in the significance of the Torah is he brings back the tracing of the development. Right? Remember we spoke about the Rambam, that one of the reasons people were so upset with the Rambam is that he didn't give any proof texts in order to give the argumentation, right? That oh-so-important principle of a rabbinic mind of machloket, of argument. So the Torah brings it back. The Torah sometimes even will go all the way back to the psukim, to the verses in the Torah, right? Bring you the Mishnah, the Gemara, the machloket rishonim, the arguments amongst the early medieval authorities, and then he'll give you his decision. Right? Most often he goes with his father's opinion, but not certainly not always. Most often, at least in Or HaChaim. So that returning that and the texture of machloket at the same time returns that Ashkenazi dialectic back to the heart of a discourse which in Spain a lot of that argumentation energy had gone into philosophy and then Kabbalah. Right? The halachic project in Spain didn't have the same energy as it had. I mean, it did have certain personalities. We'll speak about the Ran momentarily. But the sort of heart and soul of Spain at this point was moving toward the philosophical, and that's going to have consequences for the end of our story. I got to wrap the tour up. I'm watching the clock today. So I'll address Mark's question, and then we'll just talk about why now. So if you heard, what was the question, Mark?
How does he address the Bialot and talk about the Ashkenazic quantity? Obviously, there are a lot of different sort of perspectives on the Bialot.
Right. And so the answer is, if you look in Or HaChaim, daily ritual life, which is where prayer resides, the tour overwhelmingly leans Ashkenaz. He overwhelmingly goes with the Ashkenazic ritual, and that's the heart and soul of Minhag, right? And it's important to remember this dynamic always, is that what we call halakha is made up of the written law, the oral law, and Minhag, right? And you cannot separate them. If people say to you, that's just a Minhag, you should be very wary And that doesn't mean that you're bound to them all in the same ways, et cetera. Just be like, for instance, kitniot on Pesach. Pesach's coming, folks, right? Kitniot is just a minhag. Right? It's a minhag of the Rishonim, you know, the early medieval authorities, so it has quite a bit of antiquity. But if you have ever want to understand the power of identity and its confluence with law and sociology, all you have to do is drop some canola oil on a frum Ashkenazi table. Now remember, the canola was rapeseed about 40 years ago, and it was inedible. It was inedible. It wasn't just fine. It was inedible. It was actually poisonous until they genetically altered the seeds. Right? So to say that, and furthermore, it's kasher lePesach, meaning the processing, there's no chametz in it. You can't tell me that all those holy svardim out there are eating chametz on Pesach, right? But nevertheless, there are many Ashkenazim who, even looking at it, will go ballistic, right? Why? Because of the identity element. Identity is always a life or death issue, and I want you to remember that because it's a very important part of our story. And so therefore, he leans toward the minhag of Ashkenaz because that's how he prays. And so therefore, it's almost inevitable that he should see it as the proper way to do things. Boom, boom. I'm going to remember that one. Okay. But when it comes to the other three sections, he actually largely leans towards Sfard when it comes to civil law and family law and the permitted and forbidden, perhaps because that was the environment of adjudication in which he was living. Don't know. But it is, you see why your question actually reveals something quite important there, Mark. Last but certainly not least, and then we'll get to a little interesting debate about law in there, and then we'll move on to the narrative flow. Why now? Like, why suddenly? And this is the beginning of quite a long period of codification, and we've seen it before, but nevertheless, why now is important to understand is that in Spain at this point, the process of codification is sort of sweeping the nation. Alfonso X, I think in my notes it was the 10th. Alfonso X is in the process of creating a seven-part code, which was the first uniform Castilian code of law. Why do sort of kings codify law? It gives them power. Right. I mean, it's not just to show, it's control. Meaning, once you have one code of law, then the only people who are fit to sit in court are those who have mastered that law. So therefore, not only have you codified the law, you've taken control of the courts. Right? The courts historically were subject to that whole complex relationship between the nobility, the church, and the king. But once you have one code of law, you actually have a centralized government in the making. And the story of Spain leading toward the 1492, the internal story of Spain, forget the Jews, the internal story of Spain is the journey toward being arguably the first nation state of Europe. I mean, it's an anachronism. You can't call it a nation state, but certainly the first unified kingdom in the classic sense, and lays a lot of the groundwork for what we know as a nation state. And that process of unification has a lot to do with law, and not surprising to those of you who know modern European history, has a lot to do with getting rid of people who don't belong either. Right? Both the Jews and the Muslims. Because that consolidation is not just in law, it's in culture. One Catholic country is a very important element of that. So the tour is perhaps reflective of a cultural impetus toward codification in an attempt to create a unity of nation, which in bringing together the tradition of Ashkenaz and the tradition of Sephardim, he indeed does. So even though they'll continue to sort of like this periodic codification and then sort of explosion of diversity and codification will happen again in the 16th century with the Shulchan Aruch, and there'll be an explosion of diversity. The Mishnah Torah, the Mishnah Brewer will try again, at least for Orachaim, in the early 20th century, and today there's a proliferation. Nevertheless, these are points which hold us together.
Quick question. Was there also some impulse, given the pressures that the Jews were under, even before the massacres and the invasions, that they were losing a lot of their learned people?
Yeah, that's a great question.
And that this would help for especially Jewish communities that were lacking rabbinical education.
It's a great question. Was there pressure because of a sense of a loss, like the Mishnah? There was a tradition that was being lost. I haven't seen things written on it, but I would be hard-pressed to say no. Meaning, remember, the Tour and the Rosh didn't go on vacation to Spain. They went there because the culture that they had lived in had been destroyed around them, right? And they saw themselves as the inheritors of what used to be a very broad Torah culture, which has now been reduced. And so there's hard to believe that they weren't driven by some sense of, we've got to get this down. We've got to get this down. Furthermore, they encountered Spain. Spanish Jewry, as we've spoken about, and we're going to speak about more momentarily, is already over the top of its arc. And so it's very easy for me to believe that that feeling was in the air.
Well, the Rambam,
yes, but he's several hundred years earlier.
A couple of hundred years.
Yeah, 250.
The same notion, though.
Yes.
We're under attack. It'll be lost unless it gets written down.
Yep. Yeah, but he writes those letters to the Chachmei Lunil that they were the sort of like saving remnant of Am Yisrael, and the light has gone out in the world. I imagine that it was part of it. Okay, well, last piece about the tour, which is just an interesting thought for the nature of law, which is worth reflecting on, is that, you know, there are sort of two perspectives on the role that law plays in culture. And this is very important for the Jews because, of course, we're a law-based people. Remember, even in sort of the modern and postmodern era of Jewish identity in which the rabbinic project has broken down, in that sense that we no longer make a simplistic argument that what it is to be a Jew is to do the law, right? That you, I mean, you can make an ideological argument, but you do that at the cost of excluding a lot of people who see themselves as Jews. You understand? Meaning there is a whole section of Am Yisrael who's still holding up with that. What it is, a Jew is what a Jew does. And either they'll say explicitly or implicitly, therefore anybody who doesn't do Jew isn't Jewish. And that's why you get a lot of that coming out of certain segments of Am Yisrael today, consciously or not, because it's an inevitable conclusion to a need to hold fast to a definition of identity. Right? So, therefore, the question of what law is, what its purpose in the world, is quite important for us. So, and we find between the Tur and one of his later contemporaries, Rabbeinu Nissim of Girona, the Ran, and even though he's from Girona, he was not so fond of mysticism, you should just know. The Ran was the more of the analytic, philosophical camp, just to not to get confused, because we talked about the Girona school. The Rabbeinu Nissim, or the Ran, as he's known, actually display a very interesting split in their approach toward law. The Tur, well, let's lay the whole picture out. How does the Rambam begin the Mishneh Torah? Anybody know? The opening lines, anybody know what it is? No, even better. Yesod ha-yesodo v'amud ha-chochma hi leida she-yesham eloka. Right? The foundation of foundations and the pillar of wisdom is to know that there is God. And it's a philosophical foundation. Right? The Rambam's, the way he ends the Mishneh Torah is that the consciousness of God will fill the world like Mayim Liam Nechasim, like the waters fill the sea. Meaning you get a sense that the Mishneh Torah is about creating a consciousness. It's about Da'at, which I can make a good argument. I won't do it now. I've taught the class here before that the Rambam has a narrative structure that flows through the whole Mishneh Torah. And it's about consciousness. About Da'at. I translate as consciousness. So that's how he starts. How does the Tur start? Does anybody know? It's a Mishneh in Pirkei Avot. You're right. I'm going to misquote it. I should have looked it up and had it here. That you should rise like a lion in the morning to serve your creator. I'm misquoting. I apologize to everybody listening. You can look it up. But, right, the Az kinamer, you should be like mighty like a lion and fierce like a leopard and to serve your father in heaven. That's not a philosophical assertion. What is it? Behavioral, practical. The Tur wants you to get up out of bed in the morning. If you want to get up out of bed in the morning, you need to know who you're serving. And if you want to know who you're serving, then here you go. This is what you got to do. It's a pragmatic approach to law. It's a pragmatic approach to law. He also, at the beginning of Choshen Mishpat, actually treats the Mishnah and Avos that talks about there are three things upon which the world stands. Din, Emet, V'Shalom. It's Mishnah Avot, I think it's first parak, it's right at the beginning. First parak, maybe the second Mishnah. Right? But notice, you could approach this from two ways. The world stands on Din, Emet, V'Shalom. On justice, truth, and peace. Right? Like the Super Friends. Now, you approach that two ways. That's either the reason the world that was created, which would be the idealistic view, right? That's the reason the world was created, and therefore law is an expression of ideal, right? Even though you haven't actually seen it, nevertheless, that's why. Or It's the means by which the world is upheld. And then it's a pragmatic approach. You understand? That the world is upheld by justice, truth, and peace. Why was the world created, says the Torah? That's not what the law is about. What the law is about is how you keep the world afloat. Right? He is a legal pragmatist in that respect. He says that this is the means which uphold the world and not the ends toward which the world aims. Now, if you want to understand the distinction, you look in the Ran. Right? The Ran, Rabbi Nissim, is, like I said, his later contemporary. The Torah dies in 1340, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, 1340. The Ran is born in 1320 and dies in 1376. So they overlap for about 20 years, but he was his younger contemporary. The Ran has a wonderful book of drashot called, not surprisingly, the Drashot HaRan. I encourage you to read it. In particular, I encourage you to read number 11. If you're interested in early thought on how to relate what we in our society call civil and ecclesiastic law, right? The idea that ecclesiastical, that some part of law deals with God's will, and civil, some part of law just deals with sort of human society. The Drashot HaRan number Yud Aleph, number 11, is perhaps the earliest and most comprehensive treatment through the lens of what he speaks about why the Torah requires there to be a king as well as a Beit Din. There's a king as well as a rabbinic court system. And there you'll see that, as far as the Ran's concerned, all those means of upholding the world belong to the king. Right? The king has the job of maintaining the social fabric. But law is an idealistic effort. The Beit Din, you know, I'll give you an example, which, by the way, is relevant because at this point in Spain, many people don't realize, the Jewish courts in Spain had the power of execution. Well, they had the right of execution. They didn't have the power. Meaning what? They had especially the Alhamas, which were the Jewish communal structures, had at their heart Bate Din, had Jewish courts, which would adjudicate death sentences, but they wouldn't execute. They would hand over the people to be executed to the king. And this was very important in their culture because the major challenge they faced was malshinin, right? People that would betray each other to the king. And, you know, and there's a lot of money involved in this whole story here. Those of us who learned about the history of Spain together last year, you know, if you want, you can listen to the podcast, or you can corner me later, ask me questions. But there's a real question that you can't actually, according to Torah law, adjudicate legal questions of what are called capital cases, except in the high court, the Sanhedrin that was sitting on the Temple Mount. So, like, what are they doing? Sorry, this is just on, so I have a clock. I don't need people calling me right now. The answer is, well, what happens in a society where the government is unable to exercise power? I'm not going to get into the debate about whether the death penalty actually works, which is an important question, but just sort of in a simplistic sense, what happens to a society where the government can't exercise power? It's chaos, and you know, people eat each other alive. So that's not an idealistic perspective, that's a pragmatic one. So the Torah says, okay, that's what law's about, mabaya. The Ran says, that's not what law's about, that's what the king is about. You have a king for pragmatism, but the reason that the sages said that a Beit Din that executed one person every 7 years, or even perhaps every 70 years, says Rabbi Akiva, was bloodthirsty is because the role of the Beit Din is truth. The role of Beit Din is to bring out God's will and intentions for the world. You understand? So the Ran says, so pragmatically, you need a king because you need a social fabric. But that's not the role of law. The Torah, it seems, in his introduction to Kosher Mishpat, says, no, the role of law is pragmatic. Din, Emet, and Shalom, those aren't ideals toward which we're striving. They're tools by which you uphold society. Now, why does this matter? Go back to our story, because they're both writing. The Ran doesn't write a legal code, but he writes a commentary on the Gemara and on the Rif, which has a tremendous influence, a very important voice in the halachic discourse. He also was the major halachic authority of Spanish Jewry in his day. Right? Why does it matter? Because what it produces is two very, very different approaches to the role that law plays in society. Is the primary goal of the rabbis to educate or to enforce? Right? If you're an idealist, then the primary role of the rabbis is to do what? Educate, right. Because the enforcement is a failed endeavor to begin with. Now, you may have to enforce, but it's not your primary role, and it's not even your primary aspiration. But if you're a pragmatist, then the primary role of the rabbis is to do what? Enforce. That's what the law is for. You understand that this is a major split within the rabbinic establishment to this very day?
I'm not getting how they can enforce this. They can just get an answer, but they can't enforce it.
Well, there are all kinds of tools. There's social pressure. There's a relationship with civil law, like in Spain, where, you know, the Roche, there's a famous case in the Roche where there was a woman of ill repute, right, who was wreaking havoc amongst the men of the town. So instead, of course, you know, locking all the men up, he cut her nose off. Yeah. Meaning it was an effective means. He had that power because he was given it by the state. Now, understand that this debate is not irrelevant to our world. We have in the country of Israel rabbinic courts which have a direct relationship to civil power, a limited one, but a direct relationship. And we can come up with all kinds of difficult, positive, negative means, you know, et cetera, and how that works. But at the heart of it, you have individuals who have to decide, is the goal here idealistic, in which case I just need to be educating the people? I believe that Shabbat is the purpose of the world, and the best way to make that happen is to deepen people's understanding and appreciation and the value of Shabbat, et cetera. Or do I believe, no, like, these are the rules, and we got to enforce them, and therefore I'm going to push laws through Knesset to stop buses from running on Saturday? Those are two fundamentally different perspectives on law.
How does Cherem fit
into it? Cherem is a powerful tool since the time of the Gemara for enforcing the authority of the sages and the social fabric, both. Okay. Right? The nidui of a Talmid Chacham is like you don't mess with the rabbis, even if it was just a personal insult. Plus, then there's the question if you're breaking the rules, so to speak.
To run 5 minutes, you said that the Jewish courts have the power to adjudicate even the death penalty?
Yes.
Not actually happened?
Yes, it definitely happened. Definitely happened. It was well recorded. Right? Well, thank you for pointing it out. This is not a unique relationship between ecclesiastical and civil law in Spain. Right? Technically, the church didn't have the right to execute people either. And so, therefore, they were handed, there's a phrase, there's a wonderful euphemism I've forgotten for the moment, but they were sort of like handed over to the king, basically. We can't tell that story now. But I just want you to appreciate that. These questions, which are, I think, are interesting just in general, plus they're obviously relevant for the Jews of their day, are still with us now. Right? Is the primary purpose of law idealistic, and therefore the posture of the rabbis and anyone who wants to be a leader in law is primarily as an educator? Doesn't mean that you don't need to enforce, because you need rules. You need rules in a civil realm, you need rules in an ecclesiastical realm, but it's not your primary posture. Or is the purpose of law, was the Torah given in order to make order, in which case your primary role is as an enforcer, right? Like, what do I care whether you understand that it's dangerous to touch the hot stove? Stop touching the hot stove. I don't need you to believe deeply that touching the hot stove is not how the world ought to be. I need you to stop burning yourself. You understand? Those are two different postures.
Even in the United States, I mean, in New York in particular, whether it's laws about kashrut, mm-hmm. or laws about not getting a civil divorce unless you give a religious divorce.
Yeah.
So
there's always a relationship between the Jewish court system and the civil society within which it resides, right? And it just needs to be sort of clear, to, you know, sort of a clearly demarcated one. The complication here in the state of Israel is historically there was an intra-Jewish conversation about law, and then there was a negotiation vis-a-vis the non-Jewish structure. Here in the state of Israel, you can't separate those two. And so on, like, one hand, I have one of the rabbis in my neighborhood sits in, as he's a judge, not an Abbeit Din, but a judge in a civil court, an Israeli civil court. He also happens to be a rabbi. There are other rabbis in my neighborhood who actually think that makes him in violation of the Torah for many reasons. This is a complex issue, but I don't want to go too far into it because actually I got to wind out this story because we got, yeah, practical. You cold? Yeah, we can turn the heat back on. Let me just do that real quick. I have no problem going back and forth. It's just a little bit more difficult in this room than in others. 1 second.
Yeah, July is called.
Okay.
To go to a civil court.
Yeah.
Is the notion that you're not allowed to go to a civil court.
Yeah, no, the Gemara says explicitly that it's a desecration of God's name to go to a civil court.
Yeah.
So the question is that a civil court? If you have a rabbi who has the power of the state to adjudicate law, is that a civil court? I don't want to get into it right now, but you see how complicated it gets, you know? Okay. So this is the Tur dies, like I said, in 1340. The Ran dies in 1376. And things about to go downhill fast in Spain. Right? We set the stage, if you recall, with the fact that in 1265, the Reconquista, the Christian reconquest of Spain, stalled basically with the Muslims pushed into the southern tip of the Iberian Peninsula, which is called Granada. And the reason that's significant is for the Jews is that the status of the Jews within society as these loyal, diligent, talented servants now becomes loyal, diligent, talented, and easily discarded, right? And their status starts to go downhill quickly. I can't map it for you all, but there is a primary sort of story I want to tell here with real consequences for Jewish consciousness. So let's just say that the 1370s and 1380s in Spain were years of deep political instability. Already in 1378, 2 years after the Ran dies, the Archdeacon of Ecija, Ferrant Martinez, began to deliver inflammatory sermons against the Jews in Sevilla. Right? This is in a background of certain kings for whom the Jews were a primary source of not only wealth, but power, meaning the Jews were a very useful tool to the kings, even this late stage. The worse things get, by the way, politically, the more certain Jews will cleave to absolute power in order to either personally benefit or in hopes that they're going to save their people. This might sound familiar, right? So, and what you end up with is in the struggle between the king and the nobility, the Jews will pick sides, and you will end up having Jews fighting Jews on behalf of the different subsets of power in the process of the consolidation of the Spanish kingdom. Again, refer to my earlier comment. Right, so in 1378, into this mix comes religion. Right, and for 12 years, from 1738 until 1390, this archdeacon, Ferrant Martinez, is just whipping up the crowd. Remember, the history of Christian hatred of the Jews is really bound up more with the mob than with the institutional church. Now, we've spoken about many times the fact that the church, for its own reasons, gives the Jews a lowly but protected status. But they're also been training the average Christian to believe that the Jews killed their God. And furthermore, that classic role of the middleman that the Jews play between absolute power and absolute poverty is one of the great sources of hatred historically. And by the by, if you're interested in modern history, the fact that our adherence to the global power system has placed us as a nation in the same position between the great powers of the world and certain post-colonial oppressed peoples should make you think. Right? That's exactly where the state of Israel lies right now, if you've been paying attention to the news. Interesting, it's the same position that the individual Jews of Spain held primarily as tax farmers. Remembering that tax farming, the process is that the king has a nation that he has the right to tax, but it's a lot of work. You know, accountants, and you gotta have actually people go out and collect the taxes, and nobody likes that. So instead, you know what he does? He goes to a rich Jew and says, listen, I can collect 40 million reals from these people. You give me 30, and I'll let you take the rest. And so what happens is now the Jew then coughs up the cash and goes out and soaks the people for everything. And he does it with the king's henchmen at his side. You can imagine that this doesn't create the most friendly relationship, right? At the same time, it's what allows the Jews to create sort of efficient, rational, you know, financial systems in government, which means that they are part and parcel of the creation of actual efficient centralized government in Spain, right? Yeah, I can already tell you know it's not going to end well. So in October of 1390, King John I dies and is succeeded by his 11-year-old son, right? Never a good situation. Only a month later, the Archbishop of Sevilla died, and the Archdeacon, Ferrant Martinez, became the new Archbishop and therefore administrator of the entire diocese. And he immediately declares to all the clergy under his authority to destroy every synagogue send all the lamps, Hebrew books, and scrolls of the law found therein on pain of excommunication. And this time, there's no powerful king to hold in check. There's only an 11-year-old boy who, I'm not going to tell the whole story, but is beholden to him for the political machinations that actually brought him to the throne. He's become the kingmaker. Right? And so, you know, one of the great students of the Ran, Chasdei Kreskes, who was one of the more important philosophers of his day, who he wrote Or Adonai in an attempt to undermine Aristotelian thought. It was an anti-Maimonidean book. Remember, we have that in our background here, that fight. So Chasdei Kreskes writes about it this way. He says, "The Lord bent his bow like an enemy against the community of Sevilla. They set fire to its gates and killed many of its people, but most changed their religion. And some of the women and children were sold to the Muslims. Many died to sanctify his name, and many violated the Holy Covenant." My numbers here is that on June 6th, the mob attacked the Juderia, the ghetto, lest you think that such a thing was invented in Italy, from all sides, killing 4,000 Jews. The rest submitted to baptism in order to save themselves, right? Of the three large synagogues in Sevilla, two were transformed into church. And for more than a year, the violence spread between Castilla and Aragon. And when the smoke cleared, not only were thousands, if not tens of thousands, and the numbers here are always a question of hot debate, dead, but what's, according to the son of the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissen's son, who wrote in the margins of the Sefer Torah that the Ran himself had written, wrote that 140,000 Jews had converted on the wave of violence that passed through Spain in 1391. And this is, I mean, listen, massacres, sadly, at this point in Jewish history are nothing new. And they're awful and they're terrible, and we should never know from such things. What's unique about 1391 is you have now tens of thousands, if not more than 100,000 people who yesterday were Jews and today are Christians. Now, there's one thing you have to understand about the church. The church's official policy is forced baptism is forbidden. However, in a good halakhic thinking, just because it's forbidden doesn't mean it doesn't work. Meaning the act of baptism is a real act. So therefore, once you have been forcibly baptized, you are now a Christian, and if you lapse, oy vavoy. I'm sure the Pope didn't say it that way, but you get my point. So everybody has a problem. The Jews have a problem because you wake up in the morning and you want to have a shul board meeting to assess the damage, and 2/3 of your members are Catholic. So is your brother, perhaps your wife or your husband, your children. You're still living in the same streets. You still have the same communal fabric in terms of the very sort of well-developed communal political fabric which Spanish Jewry had, which was not context discussing. You just know, like American Jewry has created all these institutions and organizations. The Spanish Jewry had quite a complex communal political and social fabric. But now, it's completely intertwined with the Catholic world. Now, on one hand, it's forcible conversion. So as King, who was it? I gotta get that quote straight there. I think it was James. It was one of the Jameses. I'm not going to misquote the king. But the king of the time, he's worried about this problem, the problem of the conversos for the Spanish, because he says they're Jews in all but name, Christians in nothing but form. So I want to look at the problem from two perspectives. First, we'll look at it from the Christian's perspective because it's historically interesting but less critical for our story. And then I want to end out just with an understanding of why, aside from the tragedy of the loss of such a powerful community, why does this phase of history still matter? What changed fundamentally for the Jews in Spain that is still with us today? So first of all, from the Christian's perspective, they have a problem. The problem is you've got a large number of people who don't want to be Christians and who now are, which is why, of course, why the church opposed forced baptism. I mean, they wanted to conquer the world. They were willing to use the sword, but they understood it's bad policy. You just don't want to absorb a bunch of people who don't want to be part of your country. Sorry. And so they have a problem, and it's a double problem. Because you know what was holding most of the Jews back from success at this point in history? They were Jews. So they were excluded from all kinds of spaces, except the king was able to, like, elevate this one and elevate that one. But on the sort of general municipal or religious plane, they're Jews. You can't. Now, they're loyal, talented, diligent, and not so easily discarded. And they begin to rise through the ranks of the church, rise through the ranks of municipal authorities, rise through the ranks of the wealthy elite. That old Jewish ingenuity isn't held back any longer. And what develops in Spain is a concept of the old Christians. Right? The term which is used in Spain is Nuevos Cristos, the new Christians. Right? The word Maranos, I'm assuming at this point people know, is an insult. Most historians think it may have had its origins in some corruption of the word for pig, right? As a direct insult. You know, the linguistic roots are not so critical. It's not a word that anybody wants to be called. In Hebrew, the term is commonly anusim, right? Just people are forced converts, and that's why conversos is I think the most commonly used term today, because it implies the same thing. But the Christians have a problem because there are all these people who are technically now Christians and can move freely in society and are now, you know, and they still have access to that Jewish capital and to that Jewish ingenuity. And they're, by the way, even more clannish, because now they're going to really stick to each other. And so what develops in Spain, and there's a long history here that we're not going to go into because we can't, develops in Spain is a split between the old Christians and the new Christians. And we get around 1429 in the wake of a failed revolt, where now the conversos are going to side with certain noblemen against certain kings, and they'll be very involved in the marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella. People know Spanish history that, you know, Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile, their wedding is what creates a unified Spain. And that wedding was bound up with the conquest of Granada, which is the last non-Christian territory of the Iberian Peninsula, and the expulsion of the Jews. They conquer Granada. The Alhambra Palace, which is the great palace of the Kingdom of Granada, is where they sign the edict of expulsion for the Jews. It's all one package. You know who arranges the marriage between Ferdinand and Isabella? I'll give you one guess. The Jews. They're instrumental in making this happen. Why? Because that absolute power still offers the hope of safety. The mob, the church, the multipolar world is where danger lies. And indeed, right up to the last moment, it seems like it might work. Right up to the end, it always looks like there's hope. Right? So the old Christians are very threatened by these nouveau Christos, these new wealthy new Christians. And so they begin to band together and even manage to pass what are called the Limpieza de Sangre laws in the wake of a failed civil war. Means the purity of blood. This is the first marker that we have in Jewish history for what we today call racial anti-Semitism. That in order to advance within the church or within certain areas of the nobility, they insist that a person can prove their Christian ancestry 4 years back. And the concept of Jewish blood becomes first sort of a familiar concept. Right? Which is fascinating. Most people, of course, associate racial anti-Semitism with modernity and the Nazis, etc. So in all fairness, they deserve that tar. But you should just know, as I love to say, that if it weren't for the Nazis coming along and taking the cake for all time, that we would remember the Spanish as the great haters of the Jews. Proof of four generations. Which has also to do with their concept of nobility, which is very important in Spanish, classic Spanish culture.
No, none of these converts were actually sincere.
We're not there yet. That's the Jewish problem. Wait. The sincere converts to Christianity, you might have your own issues with it, but there are sincere converts. And, there's challenges, as we know as Jews. Like, the Jewish community is not always comfortable in its relationship with converts. But bottom line, they're as Jewish as the next Jew, and if they're enthusiastic, that's to the good. And if you feel bad about them being enthusiastic, maybe you ought to check yourself instead of worrying about them. And the Christians kind of had the same attitude. But, so, for the Christians, you have now, in addition to this world in which they're fighting against, of the new Christians, you also have that classic Christian bugbear of the Judaizers. Right? And there, here I want you to think back, we spoke about it long ago, in the origins of Christian Jew hatred, is that to a certain degree, the internal discourse of patristic Christianity, meaning say from the 2nd century to the 6th century, the internal discourse, when the Christians were trying to figure out between themselves, what does it mean to be Christian? What type of Christian? Et cetera, et cetera. The stick with which they would beat the opposing team was, you're too much like the Jews. You're a Judaizer. You're too much. And so that energy is latent within Christianity. And that great fear now, you've just absorbed the enemy, and who is now drawing people back to something which is latent within your culture. And this is where the Inquisition really, remember, it's important to remember that the Inquisition, which doesn't get introduced into Spain until 1480, I mean, the Inquisition is an office of the church, but there's a special Spanish Inquisition instituted, 1480, 1481. The Inquisition has no power over the Jews. The Inquisition is an office of the church, has a power over the Catholics. The king and the nobility have power over the Jews. Where the two meet is if the Inquisition can prove that Jews are involved with Judaizing, drawing Christians away from Christianity and back to Judaism, then they can hand them over to the king. Right, but it's a common misconception that the Inquisition was persecuting Jews. The Inquisition was persecuting conversos and any Jew it could get its hands on via the sort of civil authorities for the accusation of Judaizing. But they had a much bigger... Jews that want to be Jews and keep to themselves, okay, they had their long bad history between the Catholic Church and the Jews. They didn't have any particular problem at the moment. Their problem was the purification of the faith. That's the whole purpose of what the office of the Inquisition is for. So now what I want to do, I mean, I empathize with the problem of the Christians, but it's not really our story. I want to talk now a little bit about the problem that the Jews have, right? And it goes to the heart of the fact that not every single one of these Christians was a false convert, a forced convert. Good.
Also,
so good. Let me tell the story. You have spoken exactly where this story is going next. On July 21st in 1391, at the height of these riots, the rabbi of Burgos, Rav Shlomo Halevi, went willingly to the baptismal font and renamed himself Paulus de Santa Maria. Now, he then proceeded over the next few years to work his way up to the point where he became Bishop of Burgos. He went back to the city in where he had been rabbi and was now bishop. Now, I can show you a map. By the way, Yitzhak Ber, Professor Yitzhak Ber, who was one of the great professors of Jewish history at the Hebrew University here, has a two-volume set of books on the history of the Jews and Christians in Spain, highly worthwhile reading. In it, he has a map where you can see the visual of how devastating of the Jewish cities that became entirely Christian, or cities and villages, you know, the ones that maintained their Jewish status, the ones that became mixed. And it's astounding. You see that there was a revolution. Geographically, they're all in the same spot. Culturally, some of them have joined the other side. Some of them have been forced and they're living underground. Some of them have embraced the other side. But when Rav Shlomo Halevi, now Bishop Paul de Santa Maria, converted, he received a letter not long, and he began, by the way, to then proselytize and tell the Jews that he'd found the truth. Remember, he did this by choice in the midst of all these persecutions, right? And he sent out a letter telling the Jews that it was the time, you know, like get with the program, so to speak. He had a student, Rav Yehoshua Lorki, who, upon reading this letter, this polemic against the Jews from his former teacher, sent another letter in reply. And in that letter, we've mentioned it before, I'm going to touch it briefly because I do want to have time to end with this very important piece of the Converso Consciousness. In it, he offers four suppositions of why his teacher might have converted. And in a sense, it will set the stage for asking the very important question here, how did this happen? I mean, the history of Ashkenaz was characterized by, you know, again, whether it's numerically, literally true, it doesn't matter. The narrative is characterized by people that were willing to sacrifice their own children, slit their throats with their hands, instead of risking forced conversion, right? And here in Spain, there were certainly many people who died in sanctification in God's name, but you had tens of thousands, if not over 100,000, who converted, and some of whom who sort of joyously joined the other side. So he says, number one, maybe your appetite of soul longed to climb the rungs of wealth and honor. He wanted the good life. Maybe you just wanted the good life. It's always been hard to be a Jew. You know, sure, Zion Yid, I don't know how you say it in Spanish, but I'm sure it was true there too. Right? And even with wealth and power, you couldn't really enjoy the full life. You couldn't eat the sweet meats. You couldn't drink the best wines. You couldn't have the best ladies. You know, he said, maybe that's what you wanted. Halorki dismisses it out of hand because he recalls not only his teacher's devotion to law, but his longing for asceticism and strict simplicity. It's like, I'm not buying it. You weren't after that good life. It says, number two, maybe your faith was undermined by philosophy, which was a big issue we've discussed many times at this point in the class, that philosophy, by its universalization of wisdom, right, downgrades the importance of action. And therefore, the adherence to Jewish law becomes weak, if not irrelevant. But Halorki dismisses that as well. He says, I didn't write down his exact reply here. Right, he did. It says that philosophical knowledge, you ate the essence and cast aside the husks. There's a classic rabbinic statement. That he knew that his teacher was able to take the wisdom without the cost of diminishing his devotion. So he's got to keep going. His next is perhaps it's the unending suffering of exile. I mean, listen, we haven't spoken so much in this semester. We've spoken in the past about this sort of archetype of rabbinic thought. Right? We say it as part of the Musaf, the additional prayer on the festival holidays, right? Because of our sins, we are exiled from our land. In classic rabbinic thought, that is a statement of historical agency. It wasn't the Babylonians that destroyed the temple. It wasn't the Romans that destroyed the temple. It was we that destroyed the temple. Now, that's hard to bear, but it also means that our actions will bring us back. If it was our sins that caused us to be exiled, so it will be our merits that return us. So even though we don't have all the classic structures of agency in history, we don't have a king, we don't have a body politic, we don't have an army, we don't have an economy, you'd think we were out of the game. Say the rabbis, no. If you can do the Torah, God will bring you back. It's a way to maintain agency in history. But you know what it becomes if you say, because of our sins, we were exiled from our land. Anybody here ever seen Annie Hall? Right, there's a little clip, if you remember Annie Hall, which is a movie, by the way, should be studied very closely if you want to understand Jewish culture. Right? Why do you fast on Yom Kippur? This is for our sins. Which sins are those? I'm not really sure. Right? Meaning there's a way in which this just becomes Jewish guilt. Because of our sins. And that transition point is happening right now in Jewish history. At what point do you say, really? Really? Which sins were those that were so bad that here in the 14th century, you know, almost 1,400 years after the temple was destroyed, we're still getting walloped? And when you get to the Holocaust, of course, that's why many people will say, I'm done with this. The whole theology is bunk. There's nothing that deserves that. Right? And so the suffering of exile, says Halorki, maybe that's what made you quit. But he rejects that as well, right? Because he says that this is really nothing new in our history, and it's part of the promise of the prophets. Remember, as awful as even the Holocaust would be, I could open up the book of Devarim and read you the curses in Ki Tavoh and say, listen, you don't have to like the theology, you don't have to accept it, but this is about as bad as it gets, meaning it's an uncomfortable link to make. But for a person like, you know, Rav Shlomo HaLevi, who was immersed in Torah, this is what God said would happen. On some level, the suffering is proof of God's word. So he says then, there's one possible last reason. And you know, it's in general, in life in particular, that the last thing a person says to you is always what they wanted to say, right? You guys know that, right? When you're on the phone, oh, how you doing? By the way, you still owe me $10. Like, oh, that's why you called, you know? Right? So his last statement here deserves reflection. Perhaps there were revealed to you the secrets of prophecy and the basic principles of faith and their proof, such as were not revealed to the pillars of word of the world amongst our people during all the days of our long exile. Meaning he knew that Shlomo HaLevi had learned with Christians. And you concluded that our forefathers had inherited falsehood because of their limited understanding of the Torah and prophecy. Therefore, you chose what you chose because it is true and certain. Do you hear the pain in that? Maybe, he says, maybe you did it because the Christians are right. Because we've all been arguing about that 53rd chapter in Isaiah and how to understand this prophecy in Devarim. And the Christians have been thinking about this for 1,400 years, and you've been talking to them about that. I know that, he says to his teacher. And maybe, since it's not the good life you were after, and I know that philosophy didn't take you down, and we both know that the suffering of exile actually strengthens the Jewish argument, maybe they're just right, and you found out. And so you didn't quit. you join the winning team. Now, the difference between pain and suffering in my experience is that pain becomes suffering when you no longer have a system of meaning within which to integrate it. Right? That's why surgery can be painful, but we wouldn't call it suffering. That's why exercise is painful, but I wouldn't call it suffering. Right? That's why the great psychologist, you know, Viktor Frankl, wrote Man's Search for Meaning in his argument that what differentiated between those who lived and those who died in the camps was not their sort of vicious animal nature, but was their ability to actually find meaning in life. And can you hear the suffering in that question? Maybe, just maybe, we're all wrong, and everything that's going on around us is just a waste of time. Who was the Messiah? Don't forget, in the Barcelona dispute, 1263 that we spoke about, the question was, can you prove the truth of Christian prophecy from the rabbinic sources? Right? And that question, and by the way, that will be a devastating blow. We're not going to speak about the Tortosa disputations. We can't do everything. But again, I encourage you guys to check out the podcast if you're curious about what I have to say about it. This one, at the end of the Tortosa disputation, the majority of the rabbis who participate convert. Yeah, it's not the Ramban who the king says, I've never heard someone argue a wrong cause so well. The majority of the rabbis participating give up and convert. And you know what that does to the Jewish community only 20 so years after this? All those Christians, all those non-Christians, the crushing pressure. I'm going to make it worse. The Tortosa disputation was, of course, led by an apostate, as Pablo Cristiani, who debated the Ramban in the 13th century. That apostate's name is Geronimo de Santa Fe. You know what his Hebrew name was? Yehoshua Halorki, the student who had sent that letter to his teacher, asking him about those four possible reasons of why you converted, himself went to the baptismal font not long later, took the name Geronimo de Santa Fe, and became one of those active persecutors of his former people in Spain, to the point where he is the one that arranged the Tortosa disputation, which is arguably the final blow to Spanish Jewry. Everything that happens afterwards is just the playing it out. How many of which were conversos?
All these people who converted, even the leaders.
It's impossible to know, and that's an excellent, I don't know your name.
Miriam,
it's an excellent question, which leads us really to the last piece I want to discuss, which is, what is the converso consciousness? You know, because in order to understand this, we have to appreciate the whole structure on which we've been working since the Book of Ezra. Those of you guys who were last year in the class, that we've been working since, you know, the Book of Ezra and the Return to Zion, right, on this identity of the Jews, which is really built on the principle of us and them. Now, I know us and them has a bad name today, but for perhaps good reasons, but let's appreciate its importance in identity. Right? If you think back, or if you weren't there, you can just hear for now, that the two critical elements of the identity which was formulated, and Ezra lies at the roots of the whole rabbinic project, right, are what we call entirety and exclusivity. Exclusivity is that part of the Book of Ezra where we're the Jews and you're not, right? When all the Samaritans and the people of the hills want to come together with Zerubbabel and rebuild the temple, and he says, it's not for you to build a temple to our God. It's, by the way, the language you can see in Ezra. You can see it in Ezekiel. You can see it also in Zechariah, Malachi, and Haggai, that there's this sense that the community of the exiles are the Jews, and it's the Amei Haaretz, the peoples of the land, who are not. Now, there's a big question. The peoples of the land were Jews before, or they weren't? Did they were Jews that didn't go into exile, or they're Jews that came back and don't identify with this whole ideological movement? The answer is, we don't know. What does an Am Haaretz become later? An ignoramus, someone who's not with the rabbis. You understand that that's exclusivity, right? If I can define boundaries, I can make identity. But the other piece that goes together with it is entirety. I own the story. You don't get, once I'm exclusive about who's the Jews, so if you're not the Jews, you don't get to tell the Jewish story, right? And so the power to define communal boundary goes hand in hand, and it's chicken and egg, which one comes first, with the ability to tell the Jewish story. And that means that we're here and they're there. And by the way, on one level, good fences make good neighbors, meaning like the ability, all relationship begins with separation. If I want to relate to you, I need to respect you as you and not as a bit part in my movie, right? I have to respect, you know, healthy long-term emotional relationships need healthy boundaries. When people begin to bleed into each other, and it doesn't tend to end well. Right? And so there's a very important model for identity which carries the Jews into exile, and we're able to move through societies, not easily, move through societies, maintaining our identity and yet still interacting, gaining and enriching the societies in which we live. But up until now, the major conflict we've been having is with Christianity. Why? Because Christianity, on some level, is the first case of large-scale identity theft. Because that whole model of entirety, we are the Jews, and exclusivity, and we own our story, the Christians say, no, no, no. We are Israel, and we have the right story. I'll open up this Bible and tell you, Jew, that you never knew how to learn it properly. Right? That's what brought down Rav Shlomo Levi, and it's what brought down Yehoshua Alorki. And by the way, the bitterness, what turned them into haters of their own people? You lied to me. There were things you never told me. And by the by, I don't know what people's politics are here, but you may have noticed there's a generation coming up in America right now who looks at the state of Israel and they're saying, you lied to me. You never told me what was happening. Beware of that energy. If we are unable to look honestly at our identity and our history, then I promise you a generation will come who will be filled with that bitterness of, you lied to me. I know. I work with them.
Go back again. You lied to me. Okay? Meaning what?
Oh. You meaning in the modern discourse or in the Christian?
Okay, let's go back.
Let's go and stay in history. Because the modern, so that's what Rabbi Yehoshua Alorki's question to his teacher. Like, maybe you've been telling us all along that the Christians got it wrong, that they don't know how to read the prophets, that Jesus wasn't the Messiah, that's the big one, right? That Jesus wasn't the Messiah, you know, it's it. And suddenly you go back and you look at all these Christian arguments, and there are, trust me, the intellects that were applied were quite intelligent, impressive, extensive arguments and saying, yeah, you believe the Christians, you believe the Hebrew Bible is holy and prophetic, so do we, say the Christians. You just don't read it correctly. So for 1,500 years we've been saying the Christians, no, we're Israel, God chose us, and I'll prove it to you. Watch, I'll read the whole story. And the Christians have been saying, no, 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 we're Israel, God rejected you and chose us, and I'll prove it to you. Watch, I'll read the whole story. And then suddenly at one point you realize, oh, they're right. And you rabbis have been lying to me. You rabbis are the barrier that's preventing the Jews from seeing the light of the truth. Does this sound familiar? And so a collapse of identity begins. Now, it is not that simple, though, because those are the ones that actually chose to convert. What about the ones that didn't? They're stuck inside an identity where outwardly there's something that they don't want to be. Inwardly, there's something that they do want to be, right? And they're not safe to exercise that. And on the outside, they can see the Jews. And over there, they can see the old Christians who tell them that they're not actually Christians. And remember, 1391 is 100 years before the expulsion from Spain. And by the by, the majority of what we know so as what's called the converso nation, right, isn't just what happens in Spain, because in Spain they get ground down and crushed for 100 years before the expulsion. But you know what? Where a lot of the people from the expulsion go? Portugal. The majority of Jews just cross the border to Portugal, because the king of Portugal is like, you morons, I'll take those Jews. Except then a wave of fanaticism happens there only less than 10 years later. Right? And he mass converts those Jews. No, but those Jews have been hardened by 100 years of this fight. So they're not going to go down without a fight. So now you get the truly underground culture. And it's intergenerational. And don't forget, we don't live in the information age. What does it mean to be a Jew if you have to secretly light candles in a closet on a Friday night? Or you know you're supposed to wash your hands before you eat bread. Or there's certain things that when you're taking the communion, you've learned to say a prayer so that you prove that you're not really doing it. Right? This is the whole a consciousness where you can no longer divide between us and them. And this is what I'm driving at. The converso consciousness is a new model of identity which is born into Israel and arguably into the world through this process. Where somewhere a person believes they're a Jew, but it is an insufficient definition of a Jew to say, and I'm not a Christian, because are you really not a Christian? Maybe the first generation thought that. right? But now you have this sense where we are them. Now, one level, that's very beautiful, because this is the messianic dream that all the sort of universalist liberal energy of the world wants. Like, why should there be us and them? Like, why do I need that? Just be me. You be you, I'll be me. How about that, instead of us and them? Right? Which is a beautiful thing. At the same time, you know, there is a collective identity which exists. And so how do you negotiate that? And in coming into the early modern era, which we'll do, you know, not in the Omer, but next year, we will speak about the oh-so-critical role that the converso consciousness plays in actually birthing modernity. You know who was one of the great inheritors of converso consciousness was Baruch Spinoza. Baruch Spinoza is probably the single greatest contributor to the thought that allowed modernity and secular society to come to be. Right? Because it's an ability to recognize that society from without can press in upon me with its rules, but that my true identity exists from within. That is the converso consciousness. But that positioning of the individual against society and the recognition that all these general constructs are insufficient to define my identity, you see, this becomes a laboratory for a very painful creation of such a thing. And you know, lest you think it's just simply a coincidence of history, there's a very powerful Abarvanel. You know, Dan Yitzchak Abarvanel was the last great mind, rabbinic mind of Spain. He also happened to be the finance minister of the kings. I could tell you all kinds of stories, but we don't have the time now. So I just, and what? He was born in Spain, fled to Portugal, and came back to Spain. Yeah. He's the shelter that they took in Portugal as he was a young boy, but he was actually Spanish. I'm almost certain about that. Although if I'm wrong, please tell me. So here in the Book of Devarim, in the fourth chapter, in line 27 and 28, right? There's the what seems to be part of a curse. You've gotten children, and children, children. You're long established in the land. You act wickedly. You get kicked out. Right? Call heaven and earth to the witness against you that you shall soon perish from the land that you are crossing into. The Lord will scatter you amongst the peoples, and only a scant few of you shall be left amongst the nations to which the Lord will drive you. There you will serve man-made gods of wood and stone that cannot see, hear, eat, or smell. So says the Barvanel. You think that's a punishment, right? You're going to mess up in the land, and you'll be sent out, and you'll become an idolater. He says, I'll tell you, that's a prophecy. That it is speaking about the people of my generation, he says. He's speaking about the people of my generation because we have become the other. And that is the ultimate extent of exile. Lisbon, wrong, thank you. His family was from Spain. He must have been born there. The power there, that model of the ultimate extent of exile now is that it doesn't matter where you go physically. You've been lost internally. But you're not gone. You're not those willful converts that join Christianity or that in the secular world just leave Judaism and become part of secular society. You're the Jew who's so lost that you know you're a Jew, but you don't know what it means. You're inside some other culture, and there's no longer us and them, but you have a sense of me, which is causing you a discomfort with society. So when we pick up with the linear flow of history, again, next year, although we'll get bits of this in our discussion of modernity during the Omer program, we'll speak about how the fact that there's a notion that, you know the old versions of the Big Bang Theory? It's the old version, by the way, I've discovered recently, that when the momentum of the Big Bang finally plays out, what's going to happen? The gib, right? They're just going to all collapse back in on itself, right? Apparently, according to the physicists, is no longer how they see it, but which ruins the story. But anyway, you get my point. So there's this notion of being scattered to the four winds, which means that once you get to the four winds, what happens next? The return, right? And that makes 1492 a turning point in Jewish history. Because, of course, 1492 isn't just the fall of Granada. It's not just the Edict of Expulsion. It's also Columbus sails the ocean blue, which means that the globe has been born. You know how you get scattered all the way around the globe? Where do you end up? right back where you began. That's only true once you know it's all one thing. And as I pointed out to you before, any event which has so many multiple narratives, because of course, according to the Muslims, this is the fall of the crown jewel of the Islamic Empire. According to the Christians, it's the final consolidation of Christian Spain. According to the Jews, it's the great tragedy of the expulsion. And according to the historians, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. That's the hallmark of postmodernity. How many stories can you tell about one event? Right, all these things centering around the birth of Converso consciousness deserve a lot more discussion, which, God willing, they will get next year. For now, we got one more class up ahead, which will be, you know, there's a general principle that God never, you know, sends the Jews out from a comfortable home until he's prepared a new one for them. And that home which lies ahead in our story will be Poland, and that'll be our focus for the last class next week.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.